Welcome to the Crossbox Podcast for June of 2017, the first summer Crossbox for this year.
How is it June already?
Well, you know, time. It has that habit of flying. I'm your host, John, and with me is my co-host,
Jay.
And we got a great packed episode for you tonight, and we hope you all enjoyed our interview from last time.
We are proud to report that that Astro Base Command was successfully funded, so thanks to those of you who listened and then went to fund that game that we both think is going to be pretty cool.
Indeed.
And if you listened and didn't donate, well, I guess this is the end for us. Goodbye.
Gack!
Anyway,
we're going to kick it off with some positivity.
We are.
And after that death bit, we're going to be positive again.
I will take things first, I guess.
Certainly.
So, if you've been following the soapbox over the past couple of months, you'll have noticed that John and I have decided on some race guns for the 2018 shooting season. I am going to be building a CZ-P09 for USPSA Limited. And in doing so, I've come across, two very good little custom gunsmiths. Well, but the one I want to talk about most, though, is CZ Custom, which is not actually a part of CZ. It is an independent company, which CZ pays, probably, to make all the fancy competition parts. It's nice because the P09 is not an especially... It's not a pedigreed competition gun yet. It's not a CZ-75, say, where there's already there's a competition market to support the aftermarket. The P09 is still pretty fresh on the scene, and yet you can still get a bunch of parts for it because CZ thinks that kind of aftermarket support is important to encourage.
And unlike Glock, without the big market share, they can't just rely on it showing up. So they have to, you know, throw some money at it. And I will say it's really cool that they're willing to throw some money at it and make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even for the P09, which is not the popular CZ in competition.
Precisely.
Well, very cool.
Yep.
And we look forward to, of course, reading about it right here. My bit of positivity today is for the Corps, more specifically for the U.S. Marine Corps' Uber Squad. The Teufelhund Uber Squad, to go with the German theme I apparently have done. The Uber Squad is a test project by the Marine Corps to trial a bunch of things that they think might improve the effectiveness of the squad. And what's interesting to me is that a lot of the things I've wanted to see someone test are happening in this squad.
Is it actually called the Uber Squad?
Yes, it is. Oh, it is called the Uber Squad. That's not me. That's, you know, Chesty Puller and the Corps. In the Uber Squad, every man will have an HK416 assault rifle, which of course has that great heavy barrel made by HK. It's really nicely made and is better suited to some fully automatic fire or lots of semi-automatic fire. Every soldier will also get a silencer for his HK416, and the 240 Bravo machine guns in the support weapons company for the squad will also have suppressors. Further, the soldiers will be getting really high-tech, high-speed, low-drag helmets, the Ops Core Fast. Really nice, classic piece of kit.
So it's like a low-speed, high-drag helmet, like the old Pickelhaube.
Yeah, Pickelhaube is high-drag. These are very low-drag. They're lightweight. They're extremely comfortable. And what's more, they'll be fitted with electronic, noise-canceling hearing protection, which will also amplify quieter sounds. So this will be super high-tech, and I'm very excited to see what they think of silencers, which I think they will love. I think they will love the hearing protection. The interesting thing to me, though, is that the Uber Squad has no M249s. It's all HK416s. And now the 416 will be able to handle some more sustained fire than the M4, but will handle sustained fire not as well as the M249. So I'll be interested to see in how the Marine Corps, kind of a light infantry type force, will be able to make things work without that traditional belt-fed fire support weapon in the squad.
At the squad level. Well, it does have a super cool name.
Right? I'm very excited to see how a couple things I had thought, you know, were the way of the future and a couple things that I hadn't quite thought of as the way of the future will play out. We'll keep you up to date right here on the Soapbox.
As you you expect us to.
That's right.
Which takes us to the news.
That's right.
Today we have a pair of topics for you, as usual, although I did come up with mine, I confess, immediately before the show, so it's going to be a little bit less polished than my usual product, which is already pretty unpolished. So I think we'll let John go first.
All right.
to get you into this. Let me get the countdown for you and the timer.
Cue the music.
All right. In 3, 2, 1.
Well, keeping with my German theme, this is the Deutschlandflugzeug, which of course I've butchered. Anyway, what we've discovered is that the Germans have asked Lockheed Martin for the classified prospective buyer's briefing for the F-35A Lightning II Joint Strike. This is, of course, really interesting, partially because the F-35 is the only stealth game in town, partially because the F-35 has had kind of a tortured development process, being 3 planes in 1, and having a lot of really fancy systems in it. And also very interesting because Germany was not one of the potential, you know, initial contributors to the project. There are no jobs in Deutschland yet for the F-35, and yet they want one. Are they worried about the Russian bear? Are they worried about Tu-160s shooting cruise missiles at them? Only Merkel knows. We hope to find out how that briefing goes. I'd also like to add that the F-35, as we go to press with this, is doing what's supposed to be a really awesome demo at the Paris Air Show.
Nice.
Unfortunately, we're not there to see it. Some year.
Well, some year. Do a Patreon page next year and see if we can make enough money. SHOT Show is probably more likely than Paris Air Show, but someday.
Less travel to SHOT.
Yeah. Also, my passport's currently expired, so I need to. Yeah.
He has no papers. So never do.
Let's go back a second because
certainly
this is Germany we're talking about, right?
Yes, Germany,
big part of the Eurofighter project.
That's right. Yeah, they're one of the like largest contributor by share of the Eurofighter, I think, or maybe England. They're up there.
The good old Messerschmitt Typhoon.
Oh yeah, exactly right. And they're one of the bigger buyers with I think they're the second biggest after the Royal Air Force, and it's by not a lot of planes either.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what was very interesting to me as well, is that, you know, they've been saying for so long, it's a Typhoon, it is enough for us. Yeah, at 9, it is not enough.
I do also maybe question the wisdom of going with the F-35 when the Germans already have such well-documented problems with the upkeep of the forces they already have.
Oh, yes. But, you know, nothing says you're serious about NATO like buying a bunch of F-35s.
I don't know. I'd feel a little better if they bought, like, tanks with the money instead. What's the newest Leopard? Like a 2A7?
A7 plus.
I think if they bought, like, I don't know, 500 or 1,000 of those, I feel like they'd be in better shape against the Russian bear than they would if they'd...
Yeah, well, they I think they expect to fight to the last pull.
Mm. As is usual, yeah.
Yep. So, I don't know. It surprised me, too, for all of those reasons and more. But it's very cool. Congratulations to Lockheed. Actually, Lockheed's getting a lot of interest lately from Europe in the F-35 because it is the only stealth game in town.
I think it's been the case as the F-35 gets further along in its development, it's gotten more compelling to outside buyers.
Right. Well, you want to, like, wait for them to shake the bugs out.
Yeah.
And as they're doing so, you're seeing, hey, there's some cool stuff in there.
We'll buy these at Hornet prices when they got them figured out. And then.
Yep. Yeah. And then you had a news topic as well for us, sir.
Last-minute
pinch-hitting kind of news topic, the kind I like.
It is. Well, you want to count me down and I'll
get
into it?
3, 2, 1, go.
So, my topic for this week is the, AMD Ryzen generally, and more specifically, their EPYC server processor. Well, it is in fact called EPYC, E-P-Y-C, which, for you Russian speakers out there, just, you know, looks a lot like Erus, which sounds cool. But then again, it is a server processor, which gets me to the kind of the crux of this news item. Why would they name it that?
Yep.
I mean, you've got, on the Intel side, your Xeon, a nice, inoffensive, but still somehow fast-sounding name.
Yep.
Whereas you've got to put EPYC with a Y on a presentation to like take to the CTO and the CEO, and they've got to sign off on this processor with a silly name, despite the fact that it does actually do better at server workloads than a Xeon, because it is of course faster at multi-threaded tasks. And what do you do with servers? Multi-threaded tasks. So right. Once again, we see AMD maybe kind of dropping the ball, but I guess we'll see how it goes. The stock market seems to be doing okay, and I always, you know, root for them myself. So. There you go.
Not quite the best, like, PowerPoint thing.
Well,
I feel like they want something
They did back down a little bit from their top-end gaming processor, which, as you may be aware, is called the Threadripper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Threadripper's problematic. But I think we got to go back to the classics here in like the 70s when nobody ever got fired for buying IBM.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could even go as simple as like numbers or bring back the Athlon name. That was a golden age near history, AMD.
No, Athlon. Nice. Inoffensive.
And let's also, while I'm ranting about this, we went from Zen, which is a, I don't think it's a cool name for a processor, to Ryzen, which is, I don't know, it's like, it's what Clarkson would call a processor.
Right. Yeah. But he'd be, you know, trying to market it with a turbo on it.
That's right. It's a Ryzen.
And, you know, trying to talk about frame rates with it, which is fine. Ryzen is great if you're marketing to, you know, the gaming crowd.
It'll do 3,600 frames per minute.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, moving on, though. But let's continue along this thread, sort of, to our gaming topic. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bring up one of a game that's near and dear to both our hearts, which we'll tell you about in the comments, some tips to get it running on a modern system. But that game is Crimson Skies.
Crimson Skies. That old classic from Jordan Weissman of a... of FASA, creator of BattleTech, and Shadowrun too.
Yeah,
basically the guy who invented all of the coolest gaming properties of the 1990s.
Yeah, and this is, I believe, 2000 release.
Yeah, 2000 somewhere in there.
2000, 2001, right around there. But it's the one of the last of the great light flight sims. And that's, light, like light beer, L-I-T-E. Right,
the same great taste, fewer calories.
Yep, fewer nubbins and switches.
Yeah. And although, I mean, I feel like on gaming forums sometimes I come out against that that thing, because the people who advocate for Flight Sim Lite nowadays are mostly people who also don't like Switches at all. And right. I do like my Switches. I mean, I gotta confess, I'm a Switch kind of guy. But when it comes to a good light Flight Sim, I'm cool with that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was the time of a number of other really good games that we love, which we'll probably talk about on future episodes. X-Wing Alliance, Free Space 2, all games where you have some flight mechanics in space or in the air. Crimson Skies, of course, is in the air. So you can stall your Bloodhawk, but, you know, you don't have to worry too much about engine overheats.
And there's no forum, no sub-forum on the games forum, where some guy is pointing to these scanned copies of flight test results from the Empire State in 36, where the Bloodhawk dove 4 miles an hour faster than it does in the game. So clearly, exactly, this is a completely worthless piece of software, which is, I grant, my least favorite part of the modern flight sim community.
Yep.
Although it is really funny to read. I'll give it that.
Oh yeah, no, a technical rant is really funny, but it kind of negatively impacts, you know, sales of the flight sim. Because you have to put so much effort into getting everything exactly right. And not just 90% right, but 100% completely correct. There's no good enough when it comes to accuracy. And any time spent on that going from 90 to 100% correct on accuracy is going to be not spent on things like frame rate optimization or making the game fun.
Possibly a campaign.
Right. And Crimson Skies has it in spades. It has a wonderful campaign. Look, you are a sky pirate, okay? You have a Zeppelin aircraft carrier, and you launch your fighter aircraft from it to raid other Zeppelins as a pirate in the sky of the 1930s. What is cooler than that, ladies and gentlemen?
Let's be clear. The two of us, we stole this idea shamelessly to write stories in because it is so cool.
Exactly. Exactly. It is just so nifty and brilliant, and it's just close enough to reality to be, you know, compelling in that sense and to give you some grounding.
Oh, right. There was an interview I read with the developers of Crimson Skies way back in the day.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
They were talking about how they did the flight model coding, rather. And what they said was, it is actually more or less realistic flight modeling, except they did a couple of things. They took out spins, and they cranked up the horsepower on all the planes to, like, 2,000 to 4,000, so you can you know really make those dramatic climbing turns around.
Right, can handle.
So otherwise, they fly, maybe not state of the art, but they fly as you would expect from a 2001 flight simulator. Just you've got power to spare.
Right, and then, you know, what could be better than that? Adding more power is always a good recipe for success, especially without spins, because it lets you do a lot more of the interesting, crazy, dynamic aerial stunts that you would want
kind
to do.
Kind of, you know, the Snoopy with the scarf trailing behind you sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, again, that's very fitting with the Sky Pirate ethos. And I think one of the reasons why this game works, I mean, I alluded to it earlier, is because it is in that fictional universe. there is no, you don't have any frame of reference, but a weird, what's that, how would you describe the, like the iconic one with the biplane wings aft and the canards forward?
It's basically a bright red X-wing with a propeller instead of fusel thrust engines.
Well, precisely, yes.
Bright red X-wing, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Again, this is amazing. So yeah, that's you have no frame of reference for how that thing ought to fly.
Right.
Because, you know, how often have you flown something like that in other flight sims? And so you accept the fact that it's just this powerful beast that climbs like the Dickens and turns twice as fast as that.
Yeah, and you know, who cares if it has to have a wasp major?
It'll turn on a dime and give you a 5 cent change.
Exactly, and who cares if it has to have like a wasp major up its butt to give it that kind of power? You know, whatever. It looks right. It must fly right.
Clearly. Exactly. They fly like they look, a lot of the planes, and that's enough because, again, there's no documentation to say that's wrong.
Nope.
And
I'd also like one of the, because it was built by game designers, you know, guys who were game designers, first, second, third, and tenth. Well,
even like role-playing game designers.
Yeah. You know,
BattleTech, of course, and Shadowrun were both pen and paper things before they were computer games.
Exactly. One of the things I really liked is that, you know, there's, every plane feels different. You know, in a real flight sim, that's not really the case. And planes have their quirks, but, you know, there's not a lot of difference between an early war Messerschmitt and an early war Hurricane and an early war Spitfire. And, you know, a P-40C from early in the war. And, you know, it gets kind of samey. And other than, you know, the colors on the wings giving you a patriotic bit of fervor or not, as the case may be. Or particularly liking the lines of some aircraft. You know, there's not a lot of, you don't get the feeling of the big, heavy, slow one or the really fast one or the one that turns really good. Well, I guess that's the Zero. But, you know, that one also explodes really good.
And that's probably the quirkiest plane of them all in the real ones. I think I get what you're saying here.
Yeah.
That it's one of the things that it has going for is that not only the story and the setting, like those aren't just larger than life themselves, the airplanes are too.
Right. And you get kind of a Mario Kart feel to all the different planes. They all feel like different and they have a role and it's unique and you can switch planes and actually get a feel for them. You know, whereas, you know, if I'm flying IL-2, an excellent World War II flight sim, and I take Jay's, Yak-7?
Yak-9.
Yak-9, okay. If I take his Yak-9 and I swap it with a Focke-Wulf 190 A8, he'll be a little disappointed, but, you know, really, it's gonna not do all that much of a difference for him.
Yeah, I mean, they're broadly similar. Right. Like, one of them's more brutal, more powerful, and one of them's smaller and kind of almost daintier, I guess.
Right.
But
and there will be a little bit of loss from, you know, the optimization in your flying style. But overall, it's not quite as different as if, you know, we kicked you out of the Bloodhound.
Well, exactly.
And put you in a Balmoral.
Ugh.
Right, and then you're just like...
But I like to go fast.
Right, yeah, well, not today, Jay. Not today. Be, you know, slugging around the sky in a, you know, air tugboat.
It's another of the things to be copied from Crimson Skies was the attention to detail in that a lot of the airplanes are based on real-world things.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily German things, because the Germans were the craziest airplane builders.
There were a bunch of really weird ideas at Curtis, though. Other than the biplane...
The good old XP-55.
Exactly. Yeah. Which looks a lot like the Bloodhawk, other than not having the X wings at the back.
Well, there's another one that's actually based almost directly on it, and I forget what it's called. It's called something.
Yes.
Anyway, we'll share some pictures in the show description. Actually, I've got a bunch of them on the website because they're in my writing background folder.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but it's a really great flight sim. It's currently basically abandonware now because no one's doing anything with it or with the property, which is a real shame. But on the other hand, that means you can find it for, like, super cheap. And it will take some doing to get it to run on a modern Windows operating system, but fear not, loyal listeners, we have your back.
Take heart, it can be done.
That's right. We're on your wing, and we will help walk you through it. So stay tuned. We'll be adding a link in the description to an article that we'll put together shortly after this airs on how exactly to make this old game work on your modern computer.
We'll probably also comment on the story, so if you're interested in that, you can subscribe to the comments on the post where you listen to this podcast, and then you'll be able to get it down the line.
Exactly.
Just thinking ahead.
That's right. That's us. Let's continue our thinking ahead theme as we go to our defense topic.
That does. It moves us from a fake war to another fake war that is perhaps more likely to happen, given that it is still
in the future. It could become all too real.
Yes. Before you even know it. So, as you're well aware, tensions on the Korean Peninsula run high, as they ever do.
As they always do.
Yep.
And we decided to think a little bit about what would Korean War II Korea Harder look like.
I'm going to stick with my second Korean War thing.
No, Korea Harder is Korea much harder. Better.
All right. Well, Korea Harder. We know what we're talking about, at least.
Oh, yeah.
So, I think the first thing to get... we should explain our scenario first.
So,
there's a shooting war between North and South.
That's right.
And not like a little border skirmish.
Not a skirmish. Not like a couple artillery shells or somebody torpedoes something. No, like an actual all-out, you know... My Korean is terrible, so I don't know what "let's get it on" is in Korean, but imagine them all yelling that at each other.
Democracy versus totalitarianism. Throwdown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we might have, of course, we're not knowing sure how China would react.
Let's further specify that it's North Korea starting this war.
Yeah.
Because I think in that case, China's likely to sit on the sidelines.
Right. At least initially.
I mean,
which,
depending on like on the backroom diplomacy, if like we'll say, look, we don't want to take it over to democracy because we know you're not going to like that. We'll let you install some sort of puppet dictator of your own and just run it kind of like China, and that's infinitely better for everyone than North Korea is.
It really is. So that's our scenario, and the first thing we need to talk about is Seoul.
Seoul.
And now we're not going to go all Baptist on you, folks. We're not going to be talking about your Seoul. We're talking about Seoul, the capital of South Korea, which everyone thinks will be annihilated in the first minutes of the war.
At first glance, it's not an unreasonable fear. It is right next to the DMZ, like within artillery range from North Korea.
And North Koreans do have an awful lot of conventional gun artillery, what is colloquially referred to as tube artillery.
Pointed mostly at Seoul.
Yep.
But... a lot of that tube artillery is, in fixed positions, and the South Koreans, being enterprising technological sorts, have this wonderful thing called shot-finding radar.
Mm-hmm.
So, once they start shooting, the South Korean artillery start shooting at the other artillery, and Bob's your uncle, or maybe, like, Kim's your uncle, and...
Right.
And suddenly the artillery pointed at South Korea is, not really anymore.
We also have the South Korean Air Force, as we'll explain, is much, 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 much better than the North Korean Air Force, and this will also give additional striking capability.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, though, because...
No.
Sure, but I think what we've accepted here is that Seoul is going to take quite a pounding.
Right.
It's not going to be pleasant to be in Seoul.
No.
But it's not going to wipe the city off of the map.
No.
It's not going to kill, probably even, 5 or 10% of the population?
No.
Which, it's still a lot of people, but yes. it's not annihilation.
No.
And
let's look at cities that were annihilated in World War II, because that's the last time anyone actually annihilated a city.
Tokyo. Hiroshima.
And now, let's discount Hiroshima. That was an atomic weapon.
Ah, we're going to come to that, too.
Right? And we're going to come to atomics. So let's set atomics aside for a second. Besides, the artillery that everyone worries about is strictly conventional as far as everyone is aware. So, discount Hiroshima. Also discount Tokyo. Because Tokyo is so bad because of the B-29 dropped firebombs and the excessively wooden, the heavily wooden-based, wooden paper architecture.
Neither of which.
Of 1940s Japan.
Neither of which is a problem in Seoul at the moment.
No, it's not. They build with steel and concrete and all manner of materials, not just wood. So, okay, now we come to, say, Dresden, or Coventry, London, the Blitz. To destroy Dresden, actually that's really the only one that was destroyed,
yeah.
Right? Coventry was bombed.
Quite an excellent book about the Coventry Cathedral that I read recently, but we'll come to that again later too.
So, Dresden was bombed by a massive number of bombers, dropping an inordinate amount of ordnance on this city to blow it to bits.
Do you have a tonnage figure?
I'm afraid I don't at the present.
We should.
Slipping my mind. We'll put one in the comments. Yeah,
we'll look that up, and we'll also compare it to what you can deliver in terms of, say, per minute or per hour with a single, your standard 155 artillery piece.
Right.
And I think it'll come out pretty favorably on the comparison between what they can do to Seoul in a couple of hours and what it took the mighty 8th.
There's the RAF that hit Dresden.
No, yeah. The RAF. Whatever.
Bomber command. To destroy Dresden.
Longer, larger amount of ordnance.
It was something really for the ages, that kind of bombing. And you can even look at, arc light strikes, and a B-52's payload is going to be significantly bigger than what the North Koreans can lob at Seoul in, with their artillery pieces. And, you know, a B-52 is, you know, going to destroy, like, a one-mile strip of jungle, and Seoul's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, let's... So we'll give you some links in the show description there. And I think we've established, at least to my satisfaction, that
oh, yes.
Seoul isn't doomed. It's going to be unpleasant.
Right.
People are going to die. But yes. It's a war, and it's a total war. And, remember, World War II, even if the planes were smaller, was still a much bigger war than Korea War II, Korea Harder, would be.
Right. Also, let's point out that some of my mother's really good friends grew up in Dresden during the war and survived the bombing, along with plenty of other people. And it totally sucked, and they were miserable, and had to figure out the whole housing and food thing. But there's this part where they're alive, and at a certain level, that's what counts. So, you know, people are talking total annihilation, and that's not going
remember,
to
this
happen.
Remember, this is a city we're talking about, Dresden, that was, like, literally leveled to the foundations from one end to the other.
It
was just, like, reduced to rubble everywhere.
And, they burned it literally to the ground.
Just based on, like, area and number of guns and, like, shell throw weight, it's not going to happen to Seoul.
Nope.
Which does bring us to the what we alluded to, the nuclear weapon possibility.
That's right. Or is it?
Well,
let's figure. North Korea has what? Let's be really generous, and let's assume that their physicists are not completely incompetent, and that they've sort of kind of been able to build things. That gives them, what, 8? Let's make it an even 10
nukes. Give them 10 nukes, and 10 they could sling at South Korea.
That's right. Or Japan.
Yeah. Now, these are kind of first-generation nuclear weapons, too, so I'm not sure I'd trust them to be, number one, small enough to shoot out of your artillery tube.
They won't fit an artillery tube.
And number two, even if they could, I wouldn't trust their durability.
No, they're going to be launched via some kind of medium, short, possibly intermediate range ballistic missile.
What, ballistic missiles, John? Haven't we been working on shooting those down?
Yes, we have for a long time.
Aren't we pretty good at that now?
Yeah, we have THAAD, which has been tested quite successfully and actually has pissed off a lot of people.
Well, so not only that, we also have... your standard missile 3.
That's right, SM-3 on the Aegis, which Japan also has,
and so
South Korea has.
And in fact, we put a lot of ships around South Korea for that precise reason, because if things get hot, then we might need to shoot down missiles.
Yep.
And so that's also a tested capability, and against your intermediate range ballistic missile, it's not unlikely to be successful, I guess. I'm not sure what the actual shoot down rates are, but you've got a lot of missiles. Like a lot of defensive missiles against your 10 warheads.
Right. And these are quality systems. Remember, every time one of these systems has come up for sale and someone's bought them, China gets really, really pissy. And China has many, many, many more missiles than North Korea does.
Yeah, and of course they have reason to be upset.
I mean, because these things actually do work.
Yeah. So, there you go. The nuclear threat is not so much... Well, it's a threat, obviously, but it's not so much of a threat as it's made out to be.
That's right. There's also the small problem of, are you really going to get the United States involved in a nuclear war?
Yeah, because I think I wrote it down here, didn't I?
Yeah.
There was a line. Like, there would be a single glassy plane from Haiju in the southeast to Tan Chan in the north, southwest of the northeast.
And that'd be it.
There would be no more North Korea, which really sucks for all the North Korean people, but, you know, your guy started it. And
you did start this, you morons.
I suppose it's not especially likely that that the reclusive sorcerer kings of North Korea would care about the people getting nuked.
Yeah, but they might not like
those things pretty
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the circular error probable of a Trident warhead, say, is actually pretty darn small when you consider how big it is. It's about a 475 kiloton blast. And you can put that within a couple hundred meters of wherever you like. So enjoy your bunker while it lasted.
Precisely. So just from a self-preservation option, if the Kims want to start a war and survive it, win or lose, there's not going to be nukes.
Nope, no nukes. You're not going to use the nukes. So let's talk about conventional forces.
Let's.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed. Laughter is the best medicine. So first we're going to talk about their armor. And it makes me laugh. So, near as I can tell, North Korea is a lot like a smaller, shittier version of a Warsaw Pact client state circa 1970-something.
Oh boy.
So they have a lot of T-55-type clones, they have a lot of T-62-type clones, and their best tanks are more or less T-72s with some indigenous reactive armor. But of course, these are export model T-72s. Now, the T-72 is an interesting tank. It's very divisive. And people, we can argue quite a bit whether or not how good the T-72 is and how good you can make it with add-ons. However, we can all agree that export-grade T-72s were slaughtered by the gross lot in Desert Storm by tanks almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And our tanks have gotten better.
Hey, presto, the South Koreans are also pretty good at the whole tank game.
That's right. Yeah, they keep, you know, they've got something which is an awful lot like a vintage Abrams, you know, a Desert Storm era Abrams, and they got something that's an awful lot like a Leclerc. Some pretty solid tanks, and so, you know, that's pretty compelling, but straight up, you know, numbers don't always get you there.
Well, yeah, and as our experience with South Korean electronics companies notwithstanding, they do make, like, pretty good electronics.
Right.
And better, certainly, than whatever the North Koreans are making.
Right, and a lot of precision-guided munitions, the correct counter to a large mass of low-quality forces is, in fact, precision-guided weapons, which the South Koreans have in spades.
Tremendous spades, even.
That's right. They have lots of guided weapons. They have lots of high-end systems. They have a reasonable number of tanks, and they're much better than the North Korean tanks. So, straight up, this goes to them. The South Koreans have an excellent IFV. The North Koreans really don't. It's like an early BMP-1 clone, I think, at best. The North Koreans, of course, have kind of questionable upkeep. Basically, they're nobody's friend, at least, you know, in terms of getting military materiel. So, again, where, you know, and these are actual OG-type T-72s. These aren't, like, T-90s or anything. Actually good. They're Assad Babbles with a brand new name.
Yep. Well, I think we've comprehensively demolished the North Korean tank force because there's really nothing to discuss.
Right.
It's just
and
bad.
Artillery. Let me just mention one more thing about artillery. They're very heavily dependent on towed pieces, and don't have a lot. They have very little self-propelled artillery, and of course, towed batteries are very vulnerable to counter-battery fire. We've talked about how that will come their way from the superior South Korean electronic systems.
How they can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so let's move on. What other fields of battle do we have?
Well, they've got there's an air force. There is a Korean People's Army Air Force. Laughter is the correct response. Although the paper strength of the North Korean Air Force is a respectable 940 airplanes, none of them are any good. They've got a couple of MiG-29s. Their sources say about 40, probably, all of which deployed around Pyongyang, and there is some question about whether they have the MiG-29S, which, you know, is maybe marginally more formidable, but not really tremendously. But the consensus view is that they've got a bunch of MiG-29 Bs or UBs.
All right.
So, your kind of standard F-16A dogfighter sort of airplane, I guess. I think the As could also sling semi-active
right.
radar missiles, but only a pair of them each. And that's not a tremendous amount of BVR capability. And they've got, you know, very poor endurance that early in the MiG-29's career. Yep. So beyond those 40 airplanes, there's basically not much worth talking about. There are some MiG-23s, which I guess could maybe get the jump on you if you're, you know, not paying attention, like I often do in Falcon 4. You've got MiG-21s galore.
Not the MiG-21.
And they're not even, like, late MiG-21s. They've all got your... ye old Sidewinder B, back when it was like the Gao 8.
yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, that is atrocious. And of course, South Korea has a much better air force supplied by mostly America. South Korea has AWACS. North Korea does not. They'd be relying on ground controlled intercept until the radars got blown up,
which would be very, very shortly.
Do the North Koreans have any SAMs worthy of discussion?
I believe they've got a decent, defense setup. Although they're like it's well set up in terms of positioning and structure. It's just not modern hardware,
right? Like SA-6s.
Yeah, well, remember, like the last time North Korea could buy anything from the Russians was, I don't know, say like before the fall of the Soviet Union. So anything since then.
Yeah, you're just SOL.
I'm not sure exactly when that defense purchasing relationship cut out, but. I mean, North Korea has been a hermit state for basically my entire lifetime. And
right. So, and that would likely mean, yeah, you're looking at the so-called single-digit surface air missile systems.
Right.
None of the formidable S-300, TOR, anything, you know,
right.
Pantsir, Tunguska, anything cool like that.
Your old-timey stuff.
Yep. So, which can still make your day bad, but they're a lot easier to... They're a known quantity in terms of neutralization. Say, Jay, don't the North Koreans also have some boats?
They do. Even... I would actually say they even have 7 ships. That is, they...
Ships?
They have 3 frigates and 4 corvettes.
Oh, my God.
Of various sorts. The Navy, I think, is one that is often maligned and... largely with good reason, but I think there's a little bit to be worried about. Nothing we couldn't handle, but stuff to be worried about. So you have a bunch of missile and torpedo boats, neither of which are terribly scary, but deployed in numbers, that can be a troublesome thing in coastal waters.
Right.
Then again, we have carrier groups and Tomahawks. So
right, and Aegis destroyers.
Yeah, lots of good radar. Mm-hmm. The biggest concern is, of course, your 7D. North Korean submarines, many of which are not, real submarines. I've got to find the actual numbers here, but it's not a scary sort of thing. You have, in terms of actual biggish diesel electric submarines, like ocean going submarines, not just coastal boats, you have probably fewer than 30, and most of them are very old.
How old? Like 60s vintage?
Well, you've got your Romeos and your Whiskies.
Oh, good lord.
They've built 6 native submarines, the Sin Po class, which were produced starting about 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that 6 number is very speculative, it being North Korea and everything.
Right, but right. Questionable intel.
So those 6 submarines, if they're any good, are basically the only real threat.
Right.
Even with, the sad state of American anti-submarine warfare.
Yeah.
This one's for you, Commander Salamander.
Exactly. Nudge, nudge.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's definitely a we got this. Plus, South Korea has a lot of high-tech stuff. And actually, a small but well-put-together Navy. They've got a lot of nice ships.
Yeah. And it's, again, the whole setup of ships in the Korean People's Navy is difficult to pin down exactly, but it's not scary.
No. And once again, we're looking at really old stuff. When was the last time they could buy anything from the Soviets? Exactly.
Well, let's look at the King Sejong the Great, one of our favorite destroyer classes.
Yeah, because it's an Arleigh Burke, but a bit bigger. It's basically the Flight 3 that the U.S. Navy wanted but never got. So it's got... 48 forward, that's 128 mm-hmm. vertical launch cells, 16 harpoon Kim clone, like Korean harpoon clones, a goalkeeper Sea Whiz, a rolling airframe missile Sea Whiz, 2 triple torpedo tubes, a pair of helicopters, the Aegis, combat system, SPY-1 radars.
Build us a Burke, give us the works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Except, make it a little bigger because we want more missiles.
Yeah. Now, how many of those do they have, John?
6.
Yeah. So, in terms of large combat ships, just missile destroyers, the South Koreans have a larger navy than basically the entire North Korean navy of note.
Right. And there's also some older designs, too. That's, of course, South Korea's, newest and best and most notable ships, but they've got a bunch of other, missile destroyers and not-so-missile-y destroyers. They've got some decent stealth corvette kind of deals.
And they have some frigates, too, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And friends, which is something North Korea does not have.
Yes, they have friends. Japan seems to mostly like them most of the time.
I mean, they get into, those spats every now and then over...
They're frenemies.
Over the Second World War and, all those Japanese atrocities. But at least as far as China goes, they're in total agreement.
Yeah, they both don't like China. They both really don't like North Korea.
Gotta see if we can find that Poland ball about NATO versus Japan and South Korea.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll put that in the description if we can find it.
Yep.
So I think that about wraps us up, unless you've got more.
No, that covers it. Korea harder will be bloody, it will be miserable, but we...
Yeah, well, to put too fine a point on it, it will be a war, not
yep.
these kinetic actions we keep on getting involved in the Middle East.
Nope. Nope, nope, nope.
War is not pleasant. It's kind of fun to talk about at a distance. I mean, of course, we don't wish it on anybody, but I think that's probably where it's going to end up in the next 20 or 30 years.
Yep.
And when it does, we'll be okay.
Yep.
Speaking of being okay eventually.
Yeah.
That brings us to our third topic. We're going to explore a little bit of movie action for you.
That's right.
One of our new ones.
So, what have we got from the cinema this week?
We have Doctor Strange, the latest Marvel flick starring Benedict Cumberbatch as an American Doctor.
That's right. The titular Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm.
We both actually really enjoyed this movie.
We did.
Quite a bit. It's a good, competent, solid hero movie.
It is, and that's not really been the case for a lot of Marvel flicks of late, because they've kind of gotten into, they fall into the comic book trap of being too complicated. You've got to see the whole thing to understand even little parts of it. And Doctor Strange is nicely standalone.
Right. It's also nice because Doctor Strange is, you know, kind of the first of, it, you know, the Doctor Strange movies. So they don't feel the need to get in this upward rising spiral of massive CGI nonsense.
I do want to point out that...
craziness.
Say the Spider-Man flick coming out, or recently out, whichever it is also, it also looks pretty good to me. I mean, but it's also kind of an Iron Man vehicle, despite being a Spider-Man movie.
And right.
That's the risk you run, introducing a new character into an existing franchise, cinematic universe, what have you.
Right.
And they did not, the writers, fall into that trap.
Nope, it's just the good jackass doctor.
Yes. Himself, and there's, I guess there's a little bit of Thor in a credit scene.
Yeah, but cameos don't count.
Yeah, exactly.
No, in terms of like people with like actual roles, it's the Doctor, and that's it. That's all we're going to deal with. We're going to give him. And normally, I don't like origin stories. In this case, the origin story is justified because he's a more obscure hero, and it was very well done. There was no magical, I'm going to call it an Uncle Ben moment, where somebody has, you know, where a character has a brilliant epiphany in all of 3 seconds of film, and they go from being a normal person or something that someone that isn't a hero to someone that is, in fact, heroical.
That's just how it worked. He became, over the course of the movie, slightly less of a jerk by increments until at the end he was kind of a nice guy.
Right. And he's still kind of a jackass in the movie. And I thought this was really good because this was... First off, genuine character development, and it felt real. People who are, you know, monumental jackasses don't overnight become Mother Teresa. It just doesn't happen that way. It's a thing of increments, and they're comfortable with who they are. They like it. When you have things to challenge them, they don't roll over and say, okay, fine, I guess I'm a saint now.
And they kind of cling to the old ways.
That's right. They push back.
Kicking and screaming into being a different person eventually.
Right. Despite their best efforts.
And Doctor Strange really captures that journey very well. And I think one of the reasons it can is because it's a very focused movie by superhero standards.
Yep.
It clocks in at less than 2 hours, which is basically unheard of for a Marvel movie.
Yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous. They should really rediscover this thing called the cutting room floor.
Yeah. It falls into... it doesn't fall, rather, into the superhero trap of having too many characters.
Nope.
Of the ones that receive villain, there's basically Doctor Strange and the Ancient One, maybe.
Yep.
I mean, everyone else, like, there are arcs for other characters, but they're not well explored because they're not the main focus of the movie. They're side characters.
Yep.
This is a story about Stephen Strange and his going from brilliant neurosurgeon Stephen Strange to tortured magician Stephen Strange.
That's right. And those are the only characters you care about. I like having a solid delineation between what I want to call the A-team, which the movie's actually about. See what I did there?
Yep.
And the B-team, which is all the other bozos.
That's a good way of thinking of it.
You know, and there's a supporting cast, and you need a supporting cast. You need people to teach and to mentor and to threaten and all those good things and be threatened. But we can't focus on them. You know, you only have... If you think about this movie, I'm going to round up for a second, if you'll permit me. If you figure it's a two-hour movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it's a two-hour superhero movie, so at least an hour of that, probably more, is going to be action, fights, explosions, whatnot.
Big spectacle.
Spectacle, right? That's half the movie gone. All right, well, now you've got to have a bunch of setup for the hero. You've got to have some closing stuff. How much time, you know, you're getting down to, 30 minutes tops?
30 or 40 minutes.
Of actual character development?
Of plot advancing, character advancing story.
Right, exactly. All right, and that's not a lot. If you look at, you know, other movies, yeah, that's really not a lot of time to you know, work through a character.
Well, let's take a look at something that fits your character development into, you know, slices that big. Like your standard half-hour TV show,
right?
But we'll go to Avatar: The Last Airbender, because that's a classic example of the half an hour yet still plot-driven genre.
That's right.
Do you know what there are very few of? Episodes that focus on more than one character.
Exactly.
Do you know which episodes work the least well?
The ones that focus on more than one character.
Yeah, the ones that try to focus on more than one character.
Oh, you just don't have enough time for it.
Half an hour is about enough time to get you to root for one character.
Yep.
Especially if it's one character who's got to, like, to make a journey from being a jerk to somebody.
Right, and that's the other thing we have here, is that at the start of the movie, Doctor Strange is not an established hero yet. He's Dr. Stephen Strange. He's a brilliant neurosurgeon. He's a massive jackass, and oh yeah, he's not a superhero. And we have to get him, right? And so we have to get him to superhero-dom and, you know, being somewhat less of a jerk. And, you know, a bunch of stuff has to happen to him along the way. So that kind of speaks for most of that half hour that we have left to work with here.
Mm-hmm. So I presume in future Doctor Strange standalone movies, we'll get to see a little bit more about the characters who inhabit this universe.
That's
not
right.
To spoil anything, but there's a villain introduced toward the end who, you know, you'd probably want to see a little bit more of come the next time around, just because an interesting villain's important.
Yep. And that setup is not only welcome, but it's encouraged for superhero movies where we want to see some sequels. If you've done a good job the first time,
exactly.
you want to
go back into that universe some.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think fundamentally an origin story is interesting, but it's maybe too open-ended for a lot of people.
Right.
Me included. I like to see a story that that changes things when it finishes.
Right. I also want to comment on the CGI. Doctor Strange does have plenty of CGI. It is a superhero movie from Marvel, of course.
Mm-hmm.
However, and while I normally want to scream about CGI and grit my teeth and throw things in the general direction of the projection booth, this case, I didn't feel that at all. And I think there were a couple things to point out here. First off, it was really cool looking.
A lot of it's... Yeah, it's
CGI
visually,
was different.
Visually interesting. It's not what you usually get out of a CGI superhero.
It wasn't a lot of throwing like random Greyhound buses at each other.
Or, you know, punching from the top of a skyscraper.
Right, bolts of lightning. No. We're doing a lot of like interesting warping of space and really cool effects, starting in like a city, which already looks kind of cool. Then we're going to start like playing with it through a bunch of funhouse mirror filters. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being cool and different.
Pretty patterns. Your occasional trip through the infinite multiverse and all the strange or beautiful or creepy universes therein.
Exactly. It's different. It's fun. It kept it fresh, you know, and it still felt like a fight.
It establishes the identity of the movie, I think, really well.
Yep.
This is a movie not about superheroes in the world we live in. This is a movie about superheroes who may inhabit the world we live in, but who are fighting an entirely different one. And
yep.
you get a real sense for that through the CGI.
That's right. Now, I might be a little worried about the sequel, because often what we see with effects movies is you have the first movie in a series does something really cool. Jurassic Park gave us dinosaurs, and we've never seen dinosaurs before, and ooh, look, a T-Rex. And The Matrix gave us all that bullet-timey, whimy, wibbly-wobbly, mumbo-jumbo. And we're like, whoa. And this gave us all this, you know, building-shifting stuff. And all of that is cool once. And then, well, you've shot your bolt. You're spent. You know, your six are gone from your Smith & Wesson. What are you going to do now? What are you going to do with it? And the vast majority of filmmakers tend to give us more of the same and fall flat on their face. And then I go back to grumping at CGI and probably quoting Shakespeare about how much I don't like it.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait to see how it turns out.
But I went in Doctor Strange, you know, figuring it would be a decent popcorn movie, nothing more. I got a lot more, so I'm actually, you know, decently excited about the sequel.
Yeah, got your money out of it. Looking forward to the next one. What more can you ask out of a superhero movie?
No, I can't really think of anything.
Yep. Well, and I think that's, again, it's one of those not super common things we both happen to like a lot. So,
yeah.
Given the difference in our two tastes, the fact that it, you know, struck a nerve with both of us, suggests that no matter what you, like how you feel about either one of us, it's likely to turn out pretty well for you too. So go give it a try, even if you're not a big superhero person.
No, this one I would actually recommend to people who don't generally enjoy superhero films.
It's a good time.
Indeed.
Yep. Speaking of, you spent hopefully a good time with us, but more honestly, probably, you know, wasted another roughly an hour with us.
That's right, you silly person.
Yeah, how could you? After all this time, I thought you would have wised up. But
Yeah, figured out we were a bunch of crazy people.
Yep. Well, it's a little late in the month for an episode, but I suppose these things happen. You know, we get busy. Things occur.
Mm-hmm.
Trips happen.
Yep.
Classes
Tourniquets
happen.
Are applied.
Shooting occurs.
Yep. All those things.
Yeah, all these things happen. So, you know, I mean, I'm not really apologizing. It's still June. But maybe we'll be a little bit closer to the 15th next month. No promises, though, obviously, because it's summertime, and who can say what's going to happen between now and then?
Yeah.
I think that does wrap us up, unless you've got anything further to say.
No, that about covers it. I think I'll leave my comments about Buddy Holly and snarky songs that go with the thoughts of the 15th till later.
So, the Crossbox podcast is produced by my co-host John and me, Jay, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press, after a server migration that took a lot of the day-to-day in the background. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of ourmusicbox.com and is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press.